You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Ken Lieberthal, director of the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. Delighted you're here. For people in back, if you have trouble seating or something, there's an overflow room right next door that has additional seats and a video feed available. Really want to welcome you to this conference on the evolution of China's governance, Chinese and American perspectives. Let me give you a little bit of background, because this conference this afternoon is actually part of a larger U.S.-China project that is headed on the Chinese side by Yu Keping and his institute, and on the U.S. side by the John L. Thornton China Center. It's funded by the China-U.S. Scholarly Exchange Foundation, which is based in Hong Kong. We convened a conference last October in Beijing that brought together about 12 Chinese specialists on the Chinese political system and 12 American specialists on the Chinese political system, giving papers and extensive comments. And that set of materials, now revised, will come out in two books, one in Chinese, one in English, a little bit later this year. And four of the 12 members of the Chinese delegation to that conference are panelists in this afternoon's activities. Since this is the first of a series of sessions this afternoon, let me make a few comments about that will apply to all of the sessions and then introduce our speakers for this first session. For all of the sessions, we'll have first formal presentations. You've seen the people involved on your program. And then we've allowed significant time for a moderated Q&A afterwards, and we really look forward to your questions. For the speakers, let me mention there is someone sitting right here with a cue card set who will hold up a card saying 3 minutes, and then 2 minutes, and then 1 minute. I'm not going to tell you what happens to you after you've exhausted your 1 minute, because I'm sure none of you will do so. But we really ask all speakers to keep strictly to their time limits so that we have adequate time for discussion and to bring all of you in and address your concerns. For you in the audience, when you have a question, we will have several roving microphones. So please just put up your hand when you're recognized, wait for the roving mic, and then please stand up, first give your name and your affiliation, and then ask your question. And please, given that we have a full room and a fascinating set of topics, please keep your questions direct and short. Feel free to direct them to a particular speaker or just to the group as a whole, and anyone can answer who wants to answer them, okay? But another way to put it is, please, no speeches, just questions. Thank you. This conference really brings together scholars from both sides who have studied in depth how the Chinese political system operates and how it's evolved over time. So that really is the focus of this conference, not so much current events, but really a deep dive on the Chinese political system and its evolution. And I hope that we'll really have some high-quality discussion of those issues through the course of the afternoon. One more announcement, and then I'll introduce the speakers for this first session. The final announcement is the Thornton China Center and Brookings have recently published a number of books on China that you may find of interest. They're on a table right outside this room. They are available for purchase at the bookstore right across the hall. And those who purchase them today at the bookstore will get a 20% discount for having been to this conference. So I just thought I'd mention that in passing. Okay. Let me get to the real heart of the matter and introduce our two initial speakers. And it's really a pleasure and a privilege to have both of them at Brookings. First speaker will be Ambassador Stapleton Roy. We've been friends for 35 years, I think, at this point. And he is now the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Prior to that, he was managing director of Kissinger Associates. But that really came after an extraordinarily distinguished 45-year State Department career. He left the State Department with the rank of career ambassador. I believe there have only been three of those, five, in the history of the United States.
Five at any given time.
Oh, you misinformed me when you first got it. Okay. five at any given time. Still a very high honor, and reflective of a very distinguished diplomatic career. That career included serving as ambassador to Singapore, to Indonesia, and to the People's Republic of China. So it's really a pleasure to have Stay Pure today. And then also Professor Yu Ka-ping. Dr. Yu is professor and director of the China Center for Comparative Politics and Economics. He is also professor and director of the Center for Chinese Government Innovations at Beijing University. He holds his doctorate from Beijing University, Peking University, in political science. He has had an extraordinarily distinguished career of objective, serious, and attention-getting, I mean that in the best sense of the word, publications and speeches about the evolution of China's political system over time, so much so that the Brookings Institution a few years ago began a new series of taking key Chinese thinkers whose writings are really deserving of very wide attention, not only in China but abroad, and translating their key works. And the first book we did in that series was a book by Professor Yu Ka-ping on Democracy is a Good Thing. So without further ado, I'll ask Ambassador Roy to begin, then Professor Yu afterwards. The three of us will be up here, and we'll have Q&A from all of you. Thank you, Professor Roy. Ambassador.
Good afternoon. China, as we all know, has gone through an extraordinary economic transformation over the last 30 years. This transformation has remade the face of coastal China. It's now spilling over into the interior, and it's raised literally hundreds of millions of people to an unprecedented level of affluence. Conventional wisdom, however, shared by many Americans and much of the media, is that China's political system has remained frozen and that there have been no significant political reforms to match those in the economic sphere. This, of course, is nonsense. Political change in China has occurred on a vast scale in a number of vitally important areas affecting the day-to-day existence of ordinary Chinese. These changes encompass, first, the relationship of the government to the people. In the 1970s, China still had a totalitarian political system in which the government controlled literally every aspect of people's lives. Now, Chinese have significant freedom of choice on such matters as where they can live, where they can travel, what they can wear, what they can read, where they can work, and where they can be educated. Even with the censorship that remains in place, Chinese have access to a wider range of information than ever before, and social networking and the blogosphere have become significant factors influencing government attitudes and behavior. A second change is in the age and educational characteristics of national leaders. China is alone among modern countries in having a system of rigorously enforced age limits that apply even to its top political leaders. The top-level age limits have only been applied consistently since the 16th Party Congress in 2002. But at national, provincial, and local levels, they have dramatically and visibly altered the age structure of the leaders. As long as this practice continues, it means that the successors to top leaders are a minimum of 10 years younger than their predecessors. In China, you can't have a John McCain replace a George W. Bush or a Bill Clinton. As for the characteristics of the leaders themselves, not only are they younger, they are much better educated. In 1982, in the early stage of reform and openness, the Politburo of the Chinese Communist Party did not have a single university-educated member. In 2007, just 25 years later, 23 of the 25 members of the Politburo that emerged from the 17th Party Congress had formal university educations, and the two others were educated at an equivalent level. A third area of change is in the ideology of the Communist Party itself. In essence, the Chinese Communist Party has abandoned traditional communist ideology. Instead of class struggle, it preaches a harmonious society. Instead of claiming to be the vanguard of the proletariat, It now admits capitalist entrepreneurs to the party and claims to represent all of the people. It has embraced market economics. It has instituted an orderly process for the selection of top leaders. A fourth area of change is in the way Chinese think about political issues. This is the result of many factors, including the hundreds of thousands of students who have studied abroad, the millions who travel abroad on official trips for business or for tourism every year, the greater access to information, and the greater freedom for discussion. Tens of millions of Chinese can compare conditions in China with conditions in other countries on the basis of personal experience and observation. While the government can and does monitor expression, restrict information in certain areas, and ruthlessly suppress organizations that lack government and party approval, this is far less pervasive than it was three decades ago. These changes are not just cosmetic. As anyone who visited China in the 1970s and more recently can see, they have altered patterns of life in significant ways. What has not changed, however, is equally significant. In terms of systemic political change, evolution has been much slower. China still has a one-party system controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, which is determined not to permit any organized opposition to emerge. The government and party have been experimenting with offering greater freedom of choice, both within the party and in the selection of officials at the village level. But these changes have not yet gone very far, and the experiments with representative government at the village level have not moved from the village to the cities and the provincial capitals. In essence, the party is determined to avoid the mistakes made by Gorbachev, who in their eyes committed the cardinal error of loosening the political reins too quickly and then losing control. Most importantly, China's political system is still in a pre-modern form, in that it lacks the legitimacy that can only be provided by an electoral mechanism that provides citizens with a direct say in the selection of their rulers. China has the distinction of being the only major country in the world that lacks such an electoral mechanism. The absence of a meaningful electoral mechanism also sets China apart from the other so-called BRICS, since Brazil, Russia, and India all have some form of direct electoral process, as does South Africa and even Iran. Within the G20, only China and Saudi Arabia lack electoral mechanisms that give citizens a direct voice in the selection of national leaders. As China continues to develop economically, this omission will become even more glaringly obvious, and over time it has the potential, if not addressed, to create systemic instability. At the same time, in considering the internal logic of political development in China, we should not underestimate the impact of generational change in the leadership over the next two decades. Political change in China is likely to be driven by such generational changes in the top leaders. The fifth generation leaders who will take over next year will be the first leaders in China to have spent most of their adult careers during the period of reform and openness. Xi Jinping, the current vice president and the presumed heir apparent to the top position of general secretary of the party, was just 26 at the time of the third plenum of the 11th Central Committee, which launched the reform and openness policies. So most of his formative experiences as an adult occurred during this period. Li Keqiang, the presumptive replacement for Wang Jiabao as premier in 2013, is 2 years younger than Xi Jinping. Within the Politburo, if the age limits now in place are adhered to, 7 of the 9 members of the Standing Committee of the Politburo will have to step down to be replaced by younger leaders, and the same is true for over 40% of the full 25 members of the Politburo. The sixth generation leaders who will take over in 2022, 11 years from now, will be too young to have any memories of the Great Cultural Revolution. These leaders will be confronted with the never-ending sets of problems generated by China's rapid transformation, but their responses will be influenced by their different generational perspectives, their greater familiarity with the outside world, and China's growing integration in the global economy. It flies in the face of experience and common sense to assume that leaders with such different formative experiences will respond to the problems of managing China using canned formulas inherited from their predecessors. This is where so many analysts went wrong in assessing Gorbachev and the Soviet Union. The analysts saw Gorbachev as an apparatchik cut from the same cloth as his predecessors. That's true. But he was also the youngest Soviet leader since Stalin became General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party in 1922. It should not have been surprising that Gorbachev adopted an approach far different from the aged leaders who had preceded him, who were 20 to 25 years older than he was. I came to Washington to join the U.S. government at the end of President Eisenhower's first term. Then, after several overseas assignments, I returned to Washington during the Kennedy administration. It was like coming back to a different country, in no small measure because of the greater youthfulness of the ruling group. What do these factors mean for the evolution of governance in China? Conceivably, the economic and social changes that will occur in China over the course of the next 2 to 3 decades, including the continued emergence and maturing of middle classes, will confront China with strong and perhaps irresistible pressures for systemic political reforms. The question, as always, will be whether such reforms can take place under conditions of stability, or whether any loosening of China's political constraints will unleash uncontrollable domestic forces that will make the country less governable. There are no easy answers to this question. Deng Xiaoping's thesis, which I personally heard him outline in 1981, was that China could only succeed in economic development under conditions of stability, and only continued one-party rule by the Chinese Communist Party could ensure stability. Whatever the merits of that thesis, circumstances later in that decade suggest that continued party rule could not ensure stability in the absence of significant adaptations. That is likely to be the case in the future as well. But that still leaves the question of what sorts of adaptations will be necessary in order to provide for continued stability. Some of the lessons from China's economic development may be relevant to the course of political change in China. Why has China been able to sustain rapid growth for such an extended period? The answer is that China's leaders have been remarkably adaptable in adjusting the system to accommodate the changes that are taking place. The altered mindsets in China are enormous, far greater than many Americans realize. In essence, the party has been bold and imaginative in responding to the challenges it faced. It is too little appreciated in the United States that for the last 30 years, China has been constantly adapting as its domestic and international circumstances have changed. This has included major government reorganizations every 5 years for 3 decades. Ministries have been created or abolished. State agencies have been turned into quasi-private corporations. This willingness on the part of China to change differs sharply from what one encounters in Washington, where there is such concern over our inability to correct the problems that are making our political system, in the eyes of many Americans, increasingly dysfunctional. I attended a conference in Hainan Island a year ago in January, and it was literally stunning to find the Chinese at all levels of participation assuming that China would simply change their institutions if necessary to cope with new problems, whereas nobody in Washington thinks that our institutions can be changed, or at least nobody has found a way to do that yet. Conceivably, this same adaptability could eventually emerge in the political sphere. We should remember that within Greater China, there are already 2 alternative political systems. You have the multi-party democratic system in Taiwan, and you have the mixed elected and non-elected systems in Hong Kong and Macau. How these political systems function over the next several decades will have an influence over political developments in the rest of China. The vast majority of Chinese recognize that stability is a precondition for continued economic growth. This perception unites Chinese of widely varying political views. Does this mean that meaningful political reform will not take place? The answer is no. Elsewhere in Asia, authoritarian governments that have remained open to the outside world and been active participants in the global economy have, without exception, given rise to representative forms of governance after 30 to 40 years of rapid economic development. It happened in South Korea, it happened in Taiwan, it happened in Thailand, and it happened while I was ambassador in Indonesia. In the case of Thailand, we also see that such transitions may be fragile, subject to backsliding, especially when electoral systems produce bad leaders, which unfortunately is sometimes the case. China has only moved 15 to 25 years along this path, depending on whether you start counting the period of rapid growth from 1979 or from 1993. I prefer the 1993 date because if you look at the charts, you see that that's when you really had the sharp rise in the growth in China's GDP. To the extent that these Asian models have any relevance for China, this means that it's premature to expect significant systemic political change to occur in China in the near future. Indeed, if we want positive political change to occur in China, this will more likely be the result, not of outside pressure, but of continued rapid economic growth and generational changes within the Chinese leadership. Inevitably, the world will be watching what happens. Thank you.
Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very happy to be here. 3 years ago, I was invited to give a lecture by the Brookings Institution. Now, I come here again. So many thanks to the colleagues of the Brookings Institution for providing such a nice opportunity to me. Today, I would like to talk about China's road towards democratic governance. It's a very brief analytical overview of China's political development since reform in 1978. Over the last 32 years, China has created an economic miracle. In the 32 years between 1978 and 2010, China's GDP grew at an average annual rate of more than 9.5%. China's economy has overtaken the economies of Japan and Germany to become the world's second largest, just behind the U.S. China has also successfully withstood of the global economic crisis, which leveraged Western developed countries, achieving GDP growth of 11.2% in last year. China's foreign reserves has exceeded $3 trillion U.S. dollar and now is even the largest holder of U.S. foreign debt nowadays. The past 3 decades have witnessed China's rapid development, which astonishes the whole world. However, the world's attitudes towards the implication of China's development are very complicated. Many people in the West might say, yes, China has changed greatly in economy and is rising as a new economic power in the world. But China's politics has no big progress and particularly no great changes in her democracy. In my view, it's really a misunderstanding. Achievements in political field are obvious too in our Chinese scholars' eyes. Here, I just take some examples of the first-time reform in Chinese political history. The largest free direct election in Chinese history was carried out over huge numbers of villages and towns. Direct voting for the head of villages and the party secretary as a village. The first time in Chinese history, so large scale of direct election. Public recommendation and direct election of the party leader at the township level. Direct election of the township leader. Civil society has been emerging and playing an increasing role in social and political life. The government changed, fundamentally changed its attitudes towards civil society from the formerly prohibiting to encourage civil organizations. The last meeting before I this trip to Europe and the U.S., I participated, was held at Peking University. That conference was particularly focused on selecting 10 top events of civil society in China last year. This is rank number one. Mark Brooks opened new channels for the expression of public interest. This is rank number five. Civil society was written into the draft of the Travel's five-year plan of Shenzhen City. But of course, regrettably, last, it wasn't adopted. It's the final version. And last year, we even launched the first awards program, especially on Chinese social innovations. We encourage the civil society organizations, the behavior and the contribution to the of our modernization and the political democracy. So totally 160 civil organizations applied for this the first awards in our Chinese history. And totally we have made 10 final winners. So, rank number one, Loving Heart Package. That was the final winners. Human rights was once criticized in the past as a bourgeois rights. Now it has become a basic political value and was written into the Constitution of China. I was deeply impressed by my first paper, particularly on human rights, that published in the earlier of the 1990s. At that time, actually, I was politically criticized at that time. But now, put it into constitution. Safeguarding migrants workers' rights. Rights defending by the trade union. Ruler of law for the first time become a goal for political development and now is stipulated in constitutional provisions. The whole legal system has been established by the end of last year. Each year we have an official day to popularize law on street to the public. This picture you can see the popularizing law at the street, just at the front of the McDonald's. Constructing government under rule of law. Accountability, transparency, and the service-oriented becomes the requirements of government. Public hearing system now carried out across the country. In 1999, it just was the first practice. Or actually, this public hearing system also learned from the Western countries. Now it's nationwide practice. Democratic consultation, like democratic dialogue between the government official and the public. Public budgeting system reform had begun at the local level. Administrative system reform. Supervision system reform. One-stop shop service. Or one-stop shop administrative service. Actually, even this term, I think also learned from the Western countries, especially maybe USA, because in the Europe, when I mentioned the one-stop shop service, they don't know. They don't know why. But in China, we definitely had no such a term. So what map lines, features, dynamics, and the internal logic of China's political development? We can find five roads on the map of China's journey towards democratic governance. First, from monistic governance towards pluralist governance. Second, from centralization towards decentralization. Third, from rule of man towards rule of law. Fourth, from regulatory government towards service-oriented government. And five, from party secretary towards social democracy. From party democracy towards social democracy. We always say in China, everything in China has with Chinese characteristics. This is particularly true for China's political development. So what are characteristics of China's political development since reform? Firstly, or in first place, I would like to say incremental democratic reforms based on past dependence. China never introduced therapy, shock therapy. So just incremental democracy. A pluralist structure of governance led by the party is China's reality. A vertically and horizontally integrated structure of governance, with a special term. The core value of stability is placed above everything else. Both the rule of law and the rule of man are important instruments for governance nowadays. So, why so many great changes in political fields? In China, I always told our senior officials for Chinese road toward democracy or for Chinese democracy, the problem is not if you like or don't like. The point is we have no choice. We have to push forward democratic reform. Why? There are several basic reasons. Firstly, China began to transform its planned economy into a social market economy. Different economic foundation needs different political system. Second, people's livelihood dramatically improved and their new political demands emerge. Thirdly, different interest groups begin to form, and these groups need channels for expressing their interests and influencing decision-making. And fourth, the impact of globalization. Actually, political development has its own internal logic. So China is the same. I think the most important, or above all, is that the Chinese Communist Party has transformed from the revolutionary party into the ruling party. China is still a developing power, and the social stability are preconditions for economic development. This is why Chinese top leaders always put their priority to the stability of the whole country. Thirdly, China is a big transition from traditional society into modern one, and the incremental reform must be followed. So what challenges and reform focus in the near future? On the one hand, as I said, as I mentioned, actually we have made tremendous progress even in democracy, in Chinese politics. But on the other hand, we have to say there are a lot of formidable challenges exist or we are facing. The basic democratic institution of election, deliberation, and the supervision are far from perfect. An effective mechanism of checks and the balance of power is still not in place. The channels for public participation need to be further blunted. Lack of mechanism to counter the selfish behaviors of state bureaucracy. Corruption is still rampant in today's China. I think just 2 weeks ago, my hometown, in Zhejiang province, there was a vice mayor of Hangzhou metropolitan city. The total probability is over than 200 million of Chinese yuan. I think even in the United States is a rich man. 200 million of Chinese yuan. So corruption is still very heavy. Delivery of public service by the government is far from enough. Lack of mechanism to realize dynamic stability. Political transparency needs to be enhanced. Administrative costs are still very high. Just in these days, the central government have a movement to reduce the public expenses. We call it in Chinese three public expenses: public car, public reception, and also public consumption. So, terribly high. Rule of law still lags behind. Civil society in China is still immature. Relationships among major public organs between the party, the government, People's Congress, People's Consultative Conference need to be reshaped. So what to do? In my view, among major governance reform in the near future, including firmly pushing forward the rule of law, especially all political organizations, including CCP, and all people, all citizens, including top leaders, must act within the framework of state law, emphasizing much more upon inner party democracy and social democracy. Why we always put our emphasis upon inner party democracy? Because the party controls the most core of political power. So the inner party democracy, I think, is crucial for China's democracy. Putting much more upon social justice to reduce apparent disparities. Delivering more high quality of public service in order to establish a service-oriented government. Encouraging government innovation to make government more open, more accountable, and more efficient. Improving ecological governance to keep sustainable development. Punishing sternly corrupt officials to build a clean government. Strengthening and innovating social management. That's all what my major points on China's road towards democratic governance. Thank you for your attention. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Maybe we can turn off the projector and move this. Yeah, thank you. Gee, I wish my staff always responded as quickly and effectively when I mentioned something. Let me make two quick comments and then open this up. Comment number one is, I should have informed you earlier, all slides that are used today will be put on the Brookings website. And that's true, right? Yes. And by tomorrow, we will have a full audio of today's discussion on the website. And within several days, we'll have a full transcript on the website. So as you take notes, if you get tired, you know you can pick this up tomorrow or the day after. Secondly, we on the American side really appreciate our Chinese colleagues agreeing to do this entire session, entire afternoon in English. That is not necessarily easy for all of them. So we're having a translator to facilitate a bit. I ask, therefore, that you be sure to state your questions very clearly and concisely. It will save us translation time and facilitate our having an effective discussion. These first two presentations really teed things up wonderfully. I think we heard the themes expressed here that in one way or another are going to resonate throughout our discussions this afternoon. Rather than comment on them, let me open the floor and ask you for your questions. And again, if you'd raise your hand, and we'll get a mic to you right away. Yes, sir. And please give your name, affiliation, and then question.
My name is Judd Herriot. I'm a documentary filmmaker. The theme so far has been incremental political change in China and the merits of that. But isn't it true that incremental change has one fault? It gives the powers that are going to be, that are going to lose out in this process, it gives them a chance to mobilize against you and to derail the process. I'd like to have a comment on this from the two gentlemen.
If we look at the examples in East Asia, we find that in three of the four cases, the incremental change took place, and then there was a convulsion, and then you had more fundamental change in which the rulers basically lost control. The one exception to this was in Taiwan. And in Taiwan, you had the only leader who actually prepared for a political transition from a single-party, essentially dictatorship, to a multi-party system. And there, the incremental changes took place smoothly. So there is no guarantee that incremental changes will lead to a predetermined outcome in the absence of some leadership role in steering things toward that outcome. But the examples in Asia are so widespread, it's not just one or two, I mean, it's more than that. But the time frame is much greater than Americans want when we think about political change. We want it today or tomorrow. But it simply hasn't taken place that way. And where we look at the examples in Asia, we find that if the circumstances aren't right for stable transition to representative government, it doesn't work. Indonesia had democratic elections in 1955. It lasted less than 2 years, and you went back to guided democracy, and it wasn't until 1999 that you ended up having the next round of genuinely democratic elections. In Thailand, we have seen what was an incremental process, but it produced a democratic government that produced a very corrupt style of democratic governance, and there was a coup, and so we've had a backsliding in Thailand. After World War I, the democratic transitions in Europe failed across the board, failed so badly that they actually ended up justifying the dictatorial regimes that replaced them, because they were seen as being better and more efficient. So the process of change, if it's too fast, it fails. If it's too slow, it can be controlled by the leaders and perhaps blocked. But rapid economic development makes it impossible for leaders to hold things the way they are without introducing changes. And in large measure, that's been China's experience. For example, China's did not have a political system during the first 10 years of reform and openness to manage rapid economic change. And so you had the purging of two general secretaries of the Communist Party in a 10-year period. But after the convulsions of Tiananmen and the fall of the Soviet Union, China adopted a new, more flexible approach, redefined its ideology, adopted a different approach, and you've had nearly 20 years now of rapid economic development, and the political system has been able to manage it. But continue this for another 20 years, and the idea that you can simply stay with existing institutions in China simply doesn't hold water, in my judgment. And I think Professor Yu was largely outlining a similar type of viewpoint.
Thank you. But I'm sorry, I would like to speak in Chinese. In China, we have two, Chinese terms. One is incremental reform, the other is gradual reform. In Chinese, 渐进改革 and 增量改革. For myself, I prefer to use incremental reform rather than to gradual reform. Why? Three basic reasons. 第一个原因是因为渐进改革的 早一点是过程的缓慢性，增量改革的早一点是要增加整个国家和公民的利益。
The starting point for incremental reform is actually the process itself, but the starting point for gradual reform is actually from the government perspective.
第二呢是渐进改革呢，它整个过程啊是连续的，没有突破的。灾难改革呢，它一方面呢是渐进的，但是另外一方面呢，它经常要有突破性的改革。
When we talk about incremental reform, because why it's called incremental reform is because it's continuous without interruption. But when we talk about gradual reform, it implies breakthrough.
Yeah. 正因为有第三个灾难改革它要突破，所以呢，第三个就是刚才这位先生的问题有关，就是灾难改革跟渐进改革呢，作为执政党的共产党来讲，对这个渐进的改革它是可以掌控的，它完全在它的掌控之下，它可以主动的来选择哪些可以改，哪些可以不改。而灾难改革因为有突破性的改革，所以呢它是被动的，它主要去适应这个社会的一个变迁。所以我觉得呢，我自己是更喜欢我概括中国的改革是一种灾难改革，它一旦改革以后事实上是很难去掌控的。
Okay. When we talk about incremental reform, it's controllable, and the agency, the government has the agency to control it, and it chooses to reform what it wants it to reform or what it should not be reformed. But when we talk about gradual reform, it's not controllable or it's less controllable than.
I'm sorry. So gradual reform, that means the ruling party can control the whole process. And while the incremental reform, that means the ruling party cannot or very difficult to control reform. Why? Because according to the incremental reform policy, there are a lot of breakthrough. So maybe the whole process is very difficult to control the.
Thank you. I'm Harley Balzer from Georgetown University, and I have to confess, I spent 15 years running Georgetown's Russia-East Europe program, so I'm a little bit of an interloper. But I'm a little concerned about kind of unilaterality in the projections that are being made. You know, does generational change always go in one direction? Gorbachev was indeed 25 years younger than the people he replaced.Putin is younger than Gorbachev. He spent 5 years in Germany. Most of us wouldn't consider what's happening a positive change. And one assumes that there have to be pretty intense debates in the Chinese leadership. And the reactions that we've seen in the last few months to events in North Africa and the Middle East would suggest that there are people who are less happy about a direction that would involve more openness.And so I'd love to hear both of you comment on that.
So basically, beware of straight line projections, is that what you're saying? Yeah, okay. Who wants to take that?
I don't make straight line projections. I don't think there's anything inevitable about the process. But in a world where representative government is successful, and before the financial crisis, you didn't have a singledeveloped country in the world that didn't have a market economy and a representative form of governance. So to the extent that any country wanted to pursue a modernization process, all of the examples of modernization involved transformations both in the economic system and in the political system in one direction. Now, the financial crisis introduced complications.Because in the eyes of many people around the world, it is shown that what seemed to be a highly successful model, in fact, was less successful than it had appeared on the surface. And so this has created the potential for people coming up with alternative concepts of what the direction of change should be. And we're too early in that process to know whether that's going to develop fully fledged alternative concepts or not. But the factors that come into play are leadership,our rate of economic development, degree of openness to the outside world, and the success of the various models that exist out of there. And my comments are based on what has happened over the last 30 to 40 years, when, in my judgment, the modernization models all had the characteristics that I've mentioned. Whether that will continue to be the case over the next 20 to 30 years, I think we'll have to wait and see. Whether the successful countries now continue to be the successful countries down the road.
从总体上讲，这个领导人呢，肯定是总的说的是年轻，肯定思想更加开放，跟这个现实呢更加了解现实的这个需求。但是这肯定不是绝对的，所以呢，在中国我们一方面呢，就是强调这个领导干部要年轻化，这是中国的官方的一个政策，就是每一届官员里面必须有年轻的官员，他都有规定，省部级一定要有45岁左右的，50岁以下的。 这个地听起他都一系列的规定，但是同时他又强调呢，这不是绝对的，所以呢，就是我自己的看法是，按照我们中国的经验来讲，就是没有实践所谓的方案。总体上讲呢，应当一个国家领导人，总的说来是更加年轻会更加开放一些啊。
To answer your question that is related to the age of the leadership, and based on the China's reform experience, and we see the trend that the leadership in China is getting younger and more open-minded and more liberal, and they have more and more curiosity to know and understand the outside world. That's a general trend we see in current Chinese leadership. And we also have administrative requirement for different levels of leadership hierarchy. For example, at the provincial level, it is required that you need to have cadre under the age of 45, and also there's specific requirement for different levels of leadership in terms of age. But generally speaking, this is not absolute. And the general trend is we would like to see, and actually the party and the state is making the effort to make the leadership younger and more open-minded. That's the general trend we see.
If I could just add a comment, obviously in any generation there's going to be a huge array of views, right? So there's some uncertainty about what's going to happen always. So I think the comments here are kind of in the main, the forces at play should be shaping a more open, connected, and maybe more liberal leadership in the future than exists now. But I don't think anyone would say that absolutely, that will be the case. We'll have to see. Let's see. In back over here, this gentleman with the glasses. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Li Yuan. I'm a master's student at Georgetown University. So I have a question for Professor Yu. You were saying that the economic growth is one of the key factors for China's democratic change. However, due to the lack of a fair mechanism of resource distribution, can this huge wealth generated in the past decades, on the other hand, consolidate the current authoritative political system and the vested interest, and so that in turn hinders further political change? I want to repeat my question in Chinese again. So, Yu Jiaofeng, 您刚才说那个 就是中国经济增长是中国政治变革的一个重要因素，但是您是否认为现在这个因为缺少一个相对公正的分配机制，所以这个改革开放之后所积累的财富，是否它会反过来巩固现在的这种威权统治这种政治体制，然后进一步可能巩固这些人的少数权贵集团的既得利益，然后
阻碍进一步的政治变革。谢谢。中国的政治改革最重要的原因，就是因为经济的变迁。这从两个意义上讲，第一个呢，是我们的经济结构和经济制度变了，原来是计划经济和单纯的公有制，现在呢是市场经济和多种所有制的混合。
Well, the most important reason for the economic, for the political reform in China is because of its rapid economic development. And this has two aspects. The first is the structural aspect of it. The second is the institutional aspect of it. And we understand that China has transitioned from planned economy into a market economy. And also the ownership has also diversified from a centralized state ownership in terms of the enterprises to diversified state ownership and also private ownership in terms of enterprises.
第三个方面呢，是因为经济改革给中国带来了经济的巨大的增长。总体上来讲，所有中国人的生活水平啊都得到了明显的改善，所以呢，它就产生了新的政治需求，成为政治改革的一个进一步的动力。
Okay. Because of the dramatic economic prosperity and economic growth, people's life has improved a lot, and coming with this is the increase in political claims and political demands for people, and this is the motivation or the driving force behind political reform.
那么三十年的改革以后呢，现在就碰到一个新的问题，就是刚才你提到的，因为我们改革开放初的时候，邓小平的策略是让一部分地区，让一部分人先富起来。现在的问题是什么呢？就是这个差距太大了。这个我们每次过年的时候，新年吧，去年这个统计啊，很多令人鼓舞的 GDP 增长，收入提高，但是马上会有一组负面的消息，城乡的差距增加了，东西部的差距增加了，个人之间的差距，包括经济系数增加了。
Well, that brings a lot of new challenges and new problems. At the very beginning of our reform, Deng Xiaoping.Said that will net certain regions and certain individuals get rich first. So that was a slogan, if you remember. But we look at our current situation, we see tremendous disparities between different regions and between city and rural areas and between individuals, between the eastern part of the country and the western part of the country. And if we look at the statistics from last year, we see great numbers in terms of GDP, and these are very encouraging things. But when we look at the other disparities and other issues, and we see they are very grave.
所以呢，现在呢，就是当年邓小平是为了破除那个贫穷主义，要使得一部分人、一部分地区富起来，很好，给中国带来增长。可是现在我们的问题是这个差距太大了，所以碰到就是你说的问题了，就是我们现在呢，必须进行收入分配机制的改革，或者说叫利益分配的改革。那么利益分配的改革呢，光靠经济增长根本解决不了问题。也就是说呢，经济越增长，如果不给分配体制，不给利益分配体制，老百姓呢，他不会啊，对你政府更加满意。所以这就是我们现在碰到的问题，就是我们的政治改革现在很重要的一方面，就是怎么样使社会更加公平正义。
Well, when Deng Xiaoping made the slogan 30 years ago,to let certain regions and certain individuals get rich first. And his purpose is to break egalitarianism at that time in Chinese society. But now we're facing great disparities in Chinese society after 30 years of reform. And we see this is actually an issue of income allocation or resource allocation or interest allocation. We need to do reform in this. We need to make innovations. But all these disparities cannot be solved by economic reform.Alone, and it has to go through political reform in order to achieve social justice and social fairness.
So, 我再补充一句话，在17届五中全会之前，新华社记者对我有一个采访，所有网站都播了这个访谈，我就预言未来中国30年的改革的重点，从现在开始，就将逐渐的从经济领域。转向社会政治领域，为什么呢？就是因为现在我们这些问题，光靠经济改革解决不了，必须呢同时把重点放在社会政治体制的改革上。所以你可以看到，现在我们这个政府啊，今年最重要的一次会议，就是叫做中央党校省部级的研讨办的主题，就是社会管理体制的改革，其实已经在开始往这方面着重转移了。谢谢。
Around the time of the 5th Central Planning Committee of the 17th Party's Congress, and I was interviewed by Xinhua News Agency, and I made the following remarks. which is the focus of the government should shift from economic growth, economic reform to social and political reform, because a lot of the issues cannot be solved by economic reform alone. It has to be resolved by social and political reform. And also in our cadre training at the different levels of the government, the focus has been on social governance, the reform of social management or social governance. That's the focus of the government work.
Ken, if I can add just a footnote, because there was a piece that appeared in Bloomberg News about a month and a half ago, early March, that really impressed me. They had done some work and had figured out that the personal wealth of the top 70 members of the U.S. Congress, Senate and House combined, totals $4.5 billion. The personal wealth of the top 70, again, 70 members of the National People's Congress in China totals $75 billion. Now, the question is, if you have that much wealth at the top of your system, how can you politically manage changes that redistribute wealth? Yes, and back row standing. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Jim. I'm a reporter from Singapore. Despite the obvious differences between
Singapore... I'm sorry, what is your full name, please?
Jim Chua, C-H-U-A. Despite the obvious differences between China and Singapore, the governing model between the two countries are often compared. So I was wondering if the panelists could speak to the broad lessons the CCP could learn perhaps, or would learn perhaps, from the recent general elections in Singapore, whereby the government, despite engineering a year of 14% economic growth, witnessed a pretty strong voter backlash and the GE, and they had to obviously address a lot of voter unhappiness. So I was wondering, what lessons would there be for China going ahead?
The question is, what lessons can China learn from Singapore?
Well,
from the most recent.
What lessons would the CCP, who obviously pays a lot of attention to the governing model in Singapore, what lessons would it take from what this recent election showed? You know, the unhappiness on the ground, the greater demands for opposition voices, greater demand for democratic representation, despite the fact that it delivered 14% growth and a strong rebound from the financial crisis.
I have great respect for Lee Kuan Yew, who was the prime minister when I was the ambassador in Singapore. But I sometimes joke that if he were to die and go to hell, he would find himself the premier of China. And the point I'm trying to make has nothing to do with his personal morality. It has to do that the governance procedures that work in a country like Singapore with 3 to 4 million people simply can't work when you have the problem of scale that you run into China with its enormous geographic diversity and the enormous population masses. What you can learn from Singapore is that if a government has adequate feedback mechanisms, and if a government has a process for reasonably gauging whether the people accept the policies that are being implemented or are opposed to them, that actually you can maintain stability if the government is responsive to those types of considerations. So my experience, I learned several things from my experience in Singapore, where the elections were free, but opposition parties had a great deal of difficulty getting established. But the ruling party in Singapore never got more than 75% of the vote. So one of the lessons you learn is that even with the best governance in the world, if you want to characterize Singapore that way, ruling parties can't get more than 75% of the vote. And that tells you something about human nature. But at the same time, if it got 62% of the vote, the party would go through real soul-searching. What was going wrong? Why weren't people paying attention? And you had access to information in Singapore. So the people could express their views and the government would have to pay attention. And I think the stability in Singapore is partly a function of the fact that it has feedback mechanisms and a government that is able to monitor how people are reacting to the policies that are being implemented. When I served in the Soviet Union, the government was terrified of even raising the price of bread by a couple of kopecks or raising the price of vodka by a tiny bit because they had no way of knowing what people really thought because all feedback mechanisms were suppressed. And the result was, while I was there, for example, to raise the price of vodka, they withdrew the entire national brand of vodka and replaced it with another brand of vodka, slightly more expensive, which was the same vodka in new wine bottles. But to have to go through that process shows how really authoritarian regimes live in terror of what people really think because they can't measure it. Now, China has developed some of those feedback mechanisms, but China is changing at a breakneck speed, and that is generating the sorts of problems that Professor Yu is referring to, the enormous income disparities, the enormous geographic disparities in wealth, and the problem that Ken touched on of what do you do when the wealthy have a major role in the political system and aren't interested in wealth redistribution? This is going to be, I think, an ongoing problem for China.
这个新加坡呢，中国一直是很重视的，尤其是中国改革开放初，邓小平先生，因为新加坡作为华人社会啊，他有许多方面呢，确实是值得学习和借鉴的。比方说，他整个的老百姓的生活水平比较高，他社会比较稳定，又长期呢，这个是。
China has always been paying very close attention to Singapore, even since Deng Xiaoping era, because Singapore is an ethnic Chinese society, and there are a lot that China can learn from Singapore. We look at the different aspects of a Singapore society. For example, it's a relatively high level of livelihood in Singapore, and also the social stability in Singapore, and most interesting is the one-party rule in Singapore. So these are also our issues, all issues that China is very interested in.
但是呢，随着改革开放往前发展呢，事实上呢，中国的变化呢越来越大以后就发现呢，至少像我这样的一些学者就发现呢，新加坡的经验对中国来讲呢，局限性非常大，因为太不一样了，一个中国共产党。 党员是7500万，新加坡的全国的人口就是远远不如我们党员的一个领头。
Well, with the reform opening and reform in China pushing through, and we have experienced a tremendous changes. And in this process, we notice that the experience and lessons from Singapore have their very limitations or restrictions. For example, these two countries are very, very different, diagonally different from each other. If you look at the population of the CCP members, and we have 75 million Communist Party members, and look at the population of Singapore.
所以就是现在呢，就是我觉得呢，我们从我的角度讲呢，我觉得要如果学习，有些经验继续要学习，如果从政党这个角度来讲呢。 和学习和借鉴的最重要的一条就是呢，这个党如果真要长期执政，首先呢要满足啊这个国民的最基本的经济需求。但是光满足经济需求是远远不够的，到了一定程度以后呢，他必须要同时要直接的满足政治需求、文化需求，否则的话呢，这个党的执政地位同样会受到威胁。
But we can still learn a lot from Singapore, and in terms of the party system, and we understand if a party is going to rule for long term, it has to meet the most basic economic needs of its people. That's the first, the fundamental aspect of it. But on top of that, that's far from enough. In order to rule for long term, the party also needs to meet the political needs of the people, the cultural needs of the people.
Thank you very much. We have time for one more question, I think, over here.
Thank you. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. This is a question for Professor Yu, and it builds on the question from Singapore. You outlined in some detail the kinds of changes that you look for in governance in China, decentralization, greater government services, accountability, transparency, et cetera. I'm wondering that as you and your colleagues have looked at various models of governance around the world, and you think about your own evolution from where you are today to where you might be in a decade or so, are there any specific countries or any specific models that seem to you to be most relevant to the Chinese experience? In other words, that you might emulate in some way or another? And if so, what would those be? And the second part of the question is, in looking at those various models, you've obviously looked at the United States, and I would be interested in knowing what your view is of the most significant flaws that you see in America's governance model and governance experience today.
Boy, we only have about 2 minutes.
对，你这个是一个很大的问题，但是我很感兴趣，因为我自己啊，很重要的一个研究领域就是比较政治。
This is a very big question, but I'm personally very interested in the topic because one of my research area is comparative politics.
我觉得中国这个国家这个民族啊非常特殊，我们经常讲，刚才我已经讲了什么都带有中国特色，但是我们还有另外一方面有一个特色，其实这个民族啊，它特别注意学习。其实呢，我们一方面我们经常讲，我们坚决不照搬西方的政治制度。 但是另一方面，你可以看到呢，我们其实改革开放就在政治上，这尤其在治理上，我们其实一直是在学习和借鉴，特别是西方发达国家的经验。
As you say, China is a very unique country. It's a very unique people. And we say everything has Chinese characteristics. You are very familiar with such statement. But we have been learning from the Western countries. At the same time, we insist on we're not copying from the Western countries, but throughout the process of opening and reform, you can tell that we've been learning a lot of the good and beneficial sense from the Western institution without directly copying.
而且中国可能是唯一的一个国家，就是每年啊，派出这么多的高级官员，就是各级官员到西方发达国家学习。 首先是美国，当然美国那是要收钱的啊，哈佛大学，好多大学都有培养我们的官员，主要学习就是 governance 这方面的经验。
Okay, well, China is probably the only country that sends a lot of its high-level officials to the Western countries, especially the United States, to attend seminar or attend training or to learn and say. They have seminar and training courses at Harvard. Of course, you have to pay. And but the focus of the training is mostly governance.
这样的结果呢是什么呢？这样的结果就是我们的中国的这个 governance 呢，它就一方面呢，它还是中国的特色很浓厚。比方说刚才我讲的像 party leader， 这个我们这个党。 就是在所有的governance 这个里面 ，governance 这个治理主体里面，党肯定是最主要的，这是很明显的中国特色。但是另外一方面呢，他又把这个好多其他国家的这些 governance 的也结合到中国里面去了。所以我们一直讲呢，中国的 governance 呢，一方面是带有特色的，但另一方面呢，其实是在许多方面是有共性的，跟其他国家，包括跟美国。
When we look at the governance in China, you see it has a very strong, it still remains very very Chinese, a very strong Chinese characteristic, especially in the party leadership. And so you see on the one side, it has its unique Chinese characteristics. On the other side, it also shares some commonalities or similarities with the Western institutions, especially of the USA.
我很难说说哪个国家的这个 governance 在中国开的最好，因为这个我不能够代表别人的意见，甚至我不能够说呢到底哪个国家就是在我们的这个领导上看来是最好的。但是我觉得呢，我们的态度是什么呢？就是只要这个国家的 governance 是确实对我们有用，我们就会学习。所以就是我可以告诉你呢，是我们哪些国家我们的官员去的最多呢？就培训，首先是美国，其次是英国，英国剑桥大学、这个牛津大学都有我们那个官员的班。完了呢，德国也有，好像没有去俄罗斯的，没有去非洲的，我倒没有，我不知道，也许我们国家行政学院党校的教授，他们可能有没有送到非洲去培训的，非洲到俄罗斯培训，我不知道。反正我知道就是美国的、英国的、德国的都有。
Well, I can't say which governance model from other countries that we like best or from the party leadership's eyes and which is the best governance model. But I can tell that our leadership is always eager to learn from other countries in terms of governance. By looking at the places our party officials travel to learn or to be trained, the first and the biggest destination is the United States and then UK. And we have also a training seminar established for our cadres at Cambridge and Oxford, and also we send party officials to be trained in Germany. I don't see anybody going to Russia or African countries and these destinations. Maybe for research purpose, but different than not for training. Oh, also, Singapore is also one of destinations.
As you can see, Professor Yu is both a scholar and a diplomat. As I mentioned at the start, the themes that were struck in the formal presentations are themes I think that will carry throughout the day, but we'll look at these issues from different angles. Our next panel begins after a 15-minute break. It'll focus on trends and challenges in Chinese governance. So you have 15 minutes, but before you leave to take your break, please join me in showing our appreciation for these panelists.
Thank you.